Okay, it's about 6:05, and it's time for the Vegan Rainbow Show with Bill Houston
and Mike Hudak. Our guest today is Ron Kosla, veganic vegetable producer and director of Certified Naturally Grown, the United States' largest alternative to USDA organic certification. Ron and his wife operate Huguenot Street Farm in New Paltz, New York, a commercial vegetable farm selling to 225 local families, as well as three restaurants and two natural food stores. Since 1999, the Kostlas have farmed veganically, that is, organically, with the additional restrictions of no animal manure and no bone, blood, or fish meal. Since adopting these practices, their farm has become one of the most efficient in the northeastern United States, producing one of the highest ratios of tons of food harvested per man-hour of labor. Even as soil tests indicate continuous improvements to their soil's organic matter levels, soil structure, and nutrient ratios. Ron joins us today for a conversation about sustainable agriculture. Well, let's step back a bit from the kind of farming that you do and talk a little bit about conventional large-scale agriculture as it exists today and I guess has existed for the last 40 or 50 years. Is there anything good that you can say about it?
Yeah, definitely. We've been able to produce a lot more tons of vegetables per acre with a lot less manpower, which is important as farm kids didn't want to stay on the farm and move to cities. So we were able to meet with a technological fix the needs of a growing, more urban population in the world. So that's a very good thing. And I think also I would add, too, that we learned a lot. I mean, even though, and I think we'll probably end up talking about this too, that there are problems associated with a more chemical, petroleum-based agricultural system. By approaching it in such a, you know, nuts-and-bolts scientific way, we learned a lot about what it actually takes to grow a plant, maybe more than we did know before. So those are two main thematic good points.
And what would you say are the major deficiencies then?
The major deficiencies are, of course, a heavier reliance on petroleum, but also just the chemicals that we're using. The problem is that in order to produce so much food so apparently efficiently, we sort of hid some costs, right? So first there's the costs associated with the heavily mechanized and heavily petroleum-based agriculture, just in terms of those machines. But then there's also a cost in terms of the chemical runoff into our groundwater, our streams. And, of course, we all know the costs of I think most of your listeners are going to be familiar with the costs and the concerns of chemical pesticides and insecticides and herbicides in terms of the toxic effects they have. But then there's also the effects just of the chemical nutrients that we use in that they destroy the microorganisms in the soil, sort of basically burning them because we're sometimes, you know, injecting basically ammonia into the soil. So, there's even besides the immediate or the sort of after effect runoffs of nitrates or potassium into the water, we're actually killing and destroying the microorganisms in the soil, which leads to a less hardy plant overall. It's less disease resistant, which means then you have to use more chemical pesticides and fungicides. One interesting statistic is that in the early 1900s, before we started really using all these chemical fertilizers and pesticides, the average recorded crop loss in the United States was 15% based on disease, right? The average recorded crop loss today in the United States, when we are breaking new records for how many chemical inputs we're putting on our plants, is 15%. So things haven't really changed all that much. My wife and I grow our vegetables organically without any chemical additives, and our crop losses are, ironically, about 15%. So we haven't really changed how much the crops are being lost to disease. We've just been able to speed things up and allow fewer people to be able to do the work.
Hey, Ron, isn't it even true that some of the big farms are actually using these special strains produced by Monsanto of, like, Roundup-ready soybeans and maybe Roundup-ready corn, which are actually, they're able to, like, double the dose of pesticides that is applied?
Yeah, that's a funny thing. I mean, when they
herbicides, I guess, right?
Right. When they first marketed it, the idea was that you'd be able to use less herbicide. But because you can go through and you can just broadcast the Roundup, you end up actually using more. And, you know, New York State is one of the top soybean-producing states in the country. And we are also one of the leaders in adopting genetically modified soybeans in this state. So New York is... We're right up there with the rest of the cheerleaders for genetically modified seeds and plants.
Are there any other problems associated with these genetically modified plants than the one you mentioned, that is, of applying ever larger amounts of herbicides?
Yeah, I mean, that could be a whole nother show, just the concerns over, you know, over it getting out into the to crossbreeding with other plants, and then there's these new farm crops, PHARM, pharmaceutical crops, and that crossbreeding, and then, you know, that's the Starlink corn, that where there was a gene in the corn that some people had allergic reactions to, so could be toxic to humans. So, I mean, the list goes on and on. It's basically like a big experiment, and we don't know how bad it's going to be, but, you know, in other parts of the world, there's some really encouraging things going on with other farmers and other nations saying no. So maybe, although the U.S. won't be such a great anti-cheerleader for GM, maybe the rest of the world can help slow down the spread.
Well, speaking of the rest of the world, how have free trade agreements like NAFTA affected conventional agriculture in the United States?
I think all of those free trade type agreements are discouraging because I think they take us away from what my perception of real sustainability is. Anytime you have a free trade agreement, what you're encouraging is an industrialized, export-based agricultural system. And anytime you're encouraging that, you're encouraging mechanized monocultures of crops. Monocultures being that, you know, you plant 10,000 acres of lettuce or corn or soybeans or whatever, and you take one huge machine, because that's the cheapest way to do it, and that's the only way you're going to make money if you also have to pay for all this, you know, shipping on a boat to somewhere. So that's not good from a sustainability's perspective. Right now, this is a neat statistic that I looked up at the RAFI.org, R-A-F-I, Rural Advancement something, anyway. But they said that when you pick up the average tomato or any piece of produce off of your vegetable store shelves, that 90% of the petroleum that went into growing that crop actually went into the processing, into the washing, into the packaging, and into the transportation of that tomato, not into the actual growing of it. So anytime we have a NAFTA or a WTO or whatever, we're encouraging that 90% waste of a very precious resource.
So, Ron, the major alternative to conventional production is organic, which has in the last couple of years become an official program under the USDA. I have a statistic from a few years ago, actually before the USDA got into regulating it, and the statistic is that sales of organic produce were increasing 20 to 25% annually. I don't know how it's done in the last year or two. Do you have any numbers on that?
I have a relative number. I think in 1999, organic production accounted for about 0.3% of the food we ate in the U.S., and last year it was up to just below 1% of the food we were consuming in the U.S. So three times whatever statistic you use, it's definitely popular and it's growing fast.
Well, let's talk about the benefits of organic production, then, particularly relative to the conventional methods that we've just talked somewhat superficially about. But what do you see as the benefits of organic production for the physical environment?
Well, I think in terms of new organic, since the USDA took it over in October of 2002, the benefits still definitely include, you know, far fewer use of chemical pesticides and fertilizers. So you're definitely getting a healthier product. So many people are concerned about ingesting all these pesticide residues on their foods. So you're getting less of that. That's good. I think, though, that since the USDA took over organic, what we're seeing is that organic isn't what it used to be. People used to associate organic with small farms, and that's when you looked at the numbers of who's farming, you know, where is the organic acreage in the United States, it was mostly on small farms. Now, it is mostly on large farms, and ironically, farms that are owned by companies like Philip Morris, Dole Foods, you know, big agribusiness companies, or even not-so-agribusiness, Citigroup, has a lot of money invested into organic agriculture. So things have definitely changed, and when big agribusiness gets into something, or big business of any sort, they aren't thinking so much like the little person, oh, I want to sustain the earth and have this wonderful system. They want to make money, and making money means you're going to cut corners. So a lot of times what you see in terms of in agricultural production is not the most sustainable way of doing things, but the way to, you know, follow the letter of the law. So a lot of the lettuce, or for example, that's grown is grown in a desert with pumped up groundwater that's salinating the soil. But there's a lot fewer pests out there, so in the middle of the desert, so they don't have to spray them with the same kind of fungicides that somebody trying to grow organic lettuce or chemical lettuce here in New York would have to use. So is it good for the earth? No, to grow 10,000 acres of lettuce that Dole's doing in the middle of Arizona. But as the consumer, are you getting something with less fungicide on it? Yeah. So I guess there's good things, but maybe they're not as good as they could be.
I wonder what the definition of organic would be to a Citigroup or a Dole.
It's a marketing label. It's entirely marketing label. When you look at anybody can look around at the internet, or you know, I have to go to these organic conferences. One I went to that was put on more for the USDA and for export-oriented type people, the conversations you have there are completely different than the conversations that you have at, like, a NOFA New York, that's the Northeast Organic Farmers Association of New York, in Ithaca every year. That organization is all about small farmers who have ideals, integrity, are all about how can I take better care of my soils. You don't hear any of that going on in these. It's more like, how can we increase our export potential? How many more acres can we add? So really different ways of looking at what organic means.
When we talked earlier, you also mentioned that because of the way the organic standards were written by the USDA, that it's also resulted in a loss of genetic diversity.
Yeah, this is another problem. I just got back last week from a conference in Missouri that was attended by almost 3,000 people. It was very exciting, and it was mostly focused on heirloom seeds. The way the organic rules were written, they made some arbitrary decisions. Like, you're allowed to put, you know, an organic, certified organic farm is allowed to mulch their field with non-organic hay. So the hay could have been sprayed with fungicides or grown non-organically or whatever. So you could put tons of this stuff down on your fields. But you have to use, even though you may only be putting down a few ounces of seed, that seed has to be grown organically. Now, the problem is that there isn't a lot of availability of organic seed. And the way the rule is written is that they say that you have to use organic seed unless there isn't an equivalent variety available. So, for example, Kate and I grow 8 different kinds of broccoli. Now, we don't use treated seed. I need to differentiate it between treated seed, seed that is not treated but may have been grown from plants that are raised non-organically, and then actual certified organic seeds. There are only a few varieties of broccoli that are grown organically, and they're grown, quite a bit of them are grown. Now, there are hundreds and hundreds of varieties of broccoli that we can choose from. And each one of them is special and unique in its own way. And we need to preserve that large number of genetic diversity, A, because as organic farmers, we need any advantage that we can get, right? Like the broccolis that work on my farm may not work on my neighbor's farm because I have a different soil than they do. So Kate and I are really particular about exactly which kind of broccolis we want to choose. And we plant a number of different kinds of broccolis because we don't know what the weather's going to be like. Some of them do better some years. Some of them do better, you know, if there's less rain or more rain. So we're trying to cover our losses and or spread out the risk over different varieties. Now, if we were to choose to become certified organic, we're going to have a fight with our organic certifiers because they're going to say, hey, what's the difference between, you know, these seven varieties that you're growing and this certified organic variety? You've got to buy the certified organic variety. So that's the problem, is that a lot of organic farmers are choosing to buy these very few limited versions of certified organic seed in order to meet the new USDA requirements. Why is that dangerous? Because the people that used to be growing the greatest diversity of broccoli or lettuce or carrots or whatever were the small farmers. And now the small farmers that want to be certified organic are completely abandoning this very useful task of growing out this myriad of varieties that we've been doing for decades.
I heard a speaker at the last NOFA conference in Ithaca, and he was talking about there's actually a program. I don't recall whether it's NOFA sponsored or not, but it's encouraging small organic farmers to actually identify and even classify diversity when it pops up in their crops and to save the seeds.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think that's an official organic program, but that's a lot of what we were talking about and encouraging at this Missouri conference as well. There are a couple of programs. There's Seed Savers Exchange. It's easy to find. It's a not-for-profit on the web, and some of your listeners might like to check it out. But they, you can help grow out seeds for this organization, Seed Savers Exchange, and trade them with other members. Or if you don't feel like doing that, you can just buy seeds as well. But they have Kate worked with them 1 year and grew out 3,000 varieties of tomatoes alone, and that wasn't anywhere near the total number of tomatoes that they had. So it's a great organization, a great program. It's a for-profit company, but run with a lot of not-for-profit ideals. It's Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds, and same thing. I mean, just the amount of genetic diversity that they're maintaining and encouraging is awesome. Not certified organic, of course, but I think they're doing something much better with much higher purpose.
Around in 2002, you established an alternative certification program to the USDA's organic label, and you've already given us one indication of why you might have done that. That is to help preserve greater genetic diversity in these crops and to give you an advantage in your own business. Are there other reasons that you were led to establish this alternative certification?
The program is called Certified Naturally Grown, and it's now become the largest alternative certification program in the U.S. And when we started it, we just started it for, you know, a few farmers around the Hudson Valley. It wasn't meant to be a national program, but we started it because another frustrating aspect of the USDA National Organic Program rules was that unless you became certified organic, you weren't allowed to use the word organic to even describe your growing methods. And if you did use it, you could get fined up to $10,000 per day for your use of the word. And with the help of Cornell Cooperative Extension down here, we traced just over 40 commercial organic farmers in the three counties, Ulster, Orange, and Dutchess counties, that were selling organic produce. And we called them all up and we said, okay, are you going to become USDA certified organic? Well, 80% of them said no. There's no way. We don't want to be a part of the USDA program. It's too expensive, too much paperwork, and they felt philosophically it's supporting what they perceived then, and which has now been proven, an industrial, completely industrialized way of approaching what used to be a really sustainable method of growing. So then we're all stuck here. 80% of the commercial organic farmers down here are stuck with, what are we going to call ourselves if we can't call ourselves organic? And so we really rather randomly decided to call ourselves certified naturally grown. And to make that label, have that label use the same standards, growing practice standards, as the USDA program, but without all the paperwork. And also we make it available only to farmers that are selling locally and directly to consumers, whether it's, you know, through a farmer's market or a CSA or directly to a restaurant or a small natural food store or something like that. And we put it on the internet, and then it just spread all over the country.
Are there specific requirements of your certification that that you can point out as being stronger than the USDA's?
When,
I guess you already did that in terms of the requirement that you sell locally.
Yes, selling locally, you know, just by limiting the program to small direct market farmers, you end up doing so much, because small direct market farmers are not going to be industrialized farmers, right? They're not going to be monocrop farmers. Small farmers can't just grow usually one crop. It's too dangerous for us. And so once you're dealing with a population of small farmers, you already solve so many problems. Small farmers are growing a diversity of crops. That makes them less likely to become desperate when one of their crops does have a pest problem. Maybe a good example is organic spinach, right? Organic spinach, you're allowed to spray copper sulfate on it. Copper sulfate is an approved, allowed organic chemical fungicide, but it's still toxic. But when a farmer is just growing a lot of fields of organic spinach, they can't afford to lose that crop, and so they start spraying that spinach with copper sulfate prophylactically just so that nothing will come. We grow organic spinach too, but it's one of 40 different crops we're growing. If our spinach dies one year, we don't even really notice. And I've never, ever, ever sprayed my spinach with copper sulfate. Neither have any of the other local small, well, I should say certified naturally grown farmers around here. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah. I guess we have a call.
We have a shy caller. And I think we're, hey, what's the question there, Jeff? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Well, I'm fielding a question here from Bill's wife, actually, and she was asking kind of what she can do as far as mulch for her own garden. She's using oak leaves, and she wants to know what she can do to lower the pH. But I guess more generally, maybe you could talk to us about how you also go about fertilizing your soil.
Yeah. Well, that's a major question we were going to move into here, because one distinguishing characteristic of your operation is that you don't use any animal inputs.
Correct.
As in contrast to what organic farmers do.
Yeah, the number one nutrient source, at least in New York and California, for certified organic farms is what they call composted chicken manure, which is actually coming out of agribusiness chicken farms, and it's the dead and diseased. It is the chicken feces. It's the dead and diseased chickens that they're hauling out. It's the baby chickens. It's the, you know, the guts and whatever, and then they run that through big dryers, and it sort of gets crushed into these pellets, and then it's sold in these one-ton super sacks. And it's really cheap. It's an efficient way, I suppose, and a pseudo-organic way to fertilize your fields. The problem is that it has, you know, measurable amounts of the pesticides that went into feeding these chickens that bioaccumulated in their bodies. It has the concerns of the steroids or the hormones or the antibiotics that they were feeding them. So we didn't want to, Kate and I were vegetarian, and we didn't want to feed our vegetables a meat diet if we were eating a vegetable diet. So we wanted to figure out a way to grow without using any of the blood meal, bone meal, fish emulsion, or the composted chicken manure. And we do it with cover cropping, which means that instead of, you know, for example, any of these people that are using animal manures, instead of feeding the animal the grass or the grain or the soybeans or whatever that you would feed the animal and then harvest its poop and spread that on your fields, we grow that grass or grain or soybeans right in place, and then we till it in, and then we grow our crops into that mix. So we sort of cut out the middleman, so to speak. And there's all sorts of other good benefits that we didn't anticipate that have resulted from this system of growing. And one of them is weed control. I don't know if some of your listeners use a popular thing, at least for home gardeners, is to use horse manure. Problem with horse manure is that horses don't digest their weed seeds very well. So lots of times when you're using fresh horse manure, you end up with this very weedy garden. So we have less weeds because we're not bringing in those manures, but also because we're growing these cover crops in place in really packed concentrations, we're stifling out the weeds that would grow. And we're tilling them in based on right before the weeds that we do see are about to go to seed. So we're actually controlling our weed population, which ends up saving us a lot of time. It's part of the reason that we're able to grow so efficiently and with so few man hours of labor per man and woman hours of labor per ton harvested, because we've not eliminated, but we've vastly reduced the amount of weeding that we have to do, which is a big part of growing.
Is there any risk of disease in those blood meal and bone meal fertilizers being transmitted to the foods?
Well, historically, there's the concerns of the mad cow disease. Now, a lot of people are saying that you should only get bone meal that has been steamed. So I guess that would solve that problem if it's been steamed correctly and if it is actually steamed. I don't know what other diseases may be carried in on all those chickens and all the antibiotic residues. Then there's also problems with like right now, our neighbor is ironically losing her snap pea crop because manure also ends up attracting a lot of these root maggots, and they also like to eat seeds like pea seeds or corn seeds. So that's another problem associated with manure, is the maggots that are crawling around in the manure also end up eating your transplants and your crops if you're not careful.
Are there any other pathogens, blights, whatever, that can be transmitted into these organic crops from manure?
There's nematode problems in Washington last year. I haven't heard much about it since then, but an herbicide that they were using on pastures, it wasn't just Washington, but it was the University of Washington that really publicized this problem. The farmers were spraying an herbicide that killed broadleaf, not grasses, but it killed broadleaf weeds on their pastures. And then the horses would eat the grass and then, of course, ingest the herbicide. And then they would poop out. And then the manure would be collected and actually composted. And then the compost was spread on the farmer's fields. And this is a very persistent herbicide that was being used. And the poor farmers, broadleaf, like beans, peas, oats, some of the more sensitive crops were then dying or showing herbicide damage. And for a long time, nobody could figure it out. And then they traced it to this herbicide actually not breaking down, not in the body of the horse, not in the manure, and not in the manure even after it was composted for 18 months. So this is another thing to worry about. And I don't know how much we use that herbicide here I haven't heard so much of that problem, but I know that was getting to be a problem in pastured horses in Washington State.
I guess we have another caller.
Mm-hmm. Caller, are you there?
Yes, uh-huh.
What's your question?
Well, this question relates to something you talked about a little bit earlier, and that's the naturally...
Certified naturally grown?
Certified naturally grown or whatever it was. Yeah, I was just kind of curious, is that just for down there in the Hudson Valley, or is it happening other places, and how does that tie into this, not using animal waste as fertilizer? I mean, is that part of it, or is this thing totally separate? I guess I'd really like to know, the reason for asking all this is when I go to my local farmer's market in the summer and buy, there are a lot of organic farmers. I thought I was buying, locally things that were done right. I didn't know. I guess now if they say organic, they're done according to the federal standards. And
well,
or could somebody up here say they're certified naturally grown? I mean, are you going to try to make that a national kind of a thing?
Yeah, It's already a national thing. There are hundreds of farmers and lots of them in New York State, Pennsylvania, wherever. I don't know how far your radio program goes, but it is all over the country, in Canada, England. It's definitely spread. But something really important to point out is that, well, two things. First of all, the certified naturally grown standards don't say that people must not use manures.
Uh-huh.
That wasn't a good way to say it, but I think you get the point. But
yeah.
Even more importantly, when you buy local, that's what we really want you to do. Whether they're organic or they're certified naturally grown, the key is to buy local, because any local organic farmer that you're buying from is not going to be actually, although they may be, they're not going to be bought into this industrialized, export-oriented agribusiness way of growing the crops. And you can ask them, you know, do you use a lot of manures? How are you feeding your crops? Do you use cover crops? How are you feeding your vegetable crops? Do you use green manures? Or are you just using manures? Or are you using soybean meal or cottonseed meal or alfalfa meal? Or, I mean, there's so many vegetarian ways to feed crops, the best one being the rotations of green manures and cover crops. You can ask them right there. So no matter what, it doesn't matter whether they're organic, certified, naturally grown, or nothing. You know, they just have their own. They say, hey, we don't grow with pesticides, and we grow in an ecological fashion. They don't have to have any label. Just buy local. That's the key thing.
The only trouble is, just I'll point out, is ours is only open from the end of May until the middle of October. So you have a big gap in the middle where you have to go to the supermarkets to get things. That's a real problem.
It is. And I think if you have to go to the supermarket, it's much better to buy certified organic than conventional.
Uh-huh.
So what I'm talking about with certified naturally grown or these veganic principles, it's kind of like the next phase in sustainability, right? Encouraging local, using veganic ways of actually growing the vegetables. Mm-hmm. So it's not that you should think organic is bad, right? It's just that can we move to sustainability? Now that organic has been accepted on such a national level and embraced by the USDA rather than ridiculed like it was in the 70s and early 80s, that's great. We scored a major victory. Now, what's the next step? And the next step is going to be veganic principles and encouraging folks to buy locally.
Thanks for your call.
Ron?
Yeah?
A couple of other issues. Insect control.
Yes.
How do you do it?
Well, this is another great thing about veganic growing. Because we are so careful about our cover cropping schedule and our green manuring schedule, because we can't just throw a bunch of manure or compost on the same field year after year after year, we move our fields around. They're having these breaks of these big cover crop plantings. We're disrupting the insect and the disease cycles. So I think we have a lot less disease and insect pressures than many people do. And I think also, though, the key is, again, buying local. Local farmers are not planting large monocrops. And any time you're planting a large diversity of crop, even if you're not doing it veganically, you're still going to suffer a lot fewer problems from pests and disease.
And another issue, that of price. I understand you don't sell through a farmer's market. You
Right.
sell through subscriptions, and we didn't have time to talk about this, but it's a model called community-supported agriculture.
Yeah, we do 225 member community-supported agriculture product. Then we also sell to restaurants and grocery stores. But all of our produce is priced at, or actually it's a little below conventional produce sold in the big box grocery stores. And even when we sell on the wholesale market to the restaurants or to the grocery stores, we're still selling at the same price usually for conventional products. And it's not so hard to do. I mean, growing veganically is so much more efficient than dealing with all those manures and the weeds and the disease that might come from growing in the same field year after year, that you quickly realize that you can meet their prices. I mean, obviously, we're not selling through a distributor, so we're still getting a lot more than the average tomato farmer in California where, you know, they're paying for trucking, they're paying for the two middlemen and the grocery store. But organic food doesn't have to be more expensive than conventional food.
Ron, getting back to the subject of fertilizers, you know, non-veganic fertilizers, I read a book once called Toxic Sludge is Good for You. And the book is mainly about the public relations industry, but the title of the book comes from a story where the authors of the book found that when you go to your, you know, local Walmart or something and buy, you know, a 50-pound bag of potting soil, a lot of times it turns out to be sewer sludge waste.
Yes, it's true.
And I was wondering if that might be, I believe that there was a, you know, what was the outbreak just recently in Maryland at some restaurants from Sprouts, I believe. I think it was a, you know, encephalitis or something that's normally you pick up from handling sewage.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if maybe that there's a connection between using this sewer sludge waste and how prevalent it is.
Yeah, I don't know, but it seems like just one more concern. I mean, the other concerns are the chemicals in the sewage sludge and the heavy metals, of course, because what we put down our municipal drains is not all just good old human poop. It's a heck of a lot of other things. So, yeah, this isn't a great idea, the whole sludge plan.
I mean, do you know if people go to, you know, Walmart or something and buy, or, you know, or Agway or whatever, and buy, I mean, can you tell by looking at the label if this is sewer sludge or not?
I don't know, but I know that you used to not be able to tell, and it was something that was a concern, at least, you know, as late as the latter 90s. But I wonder if there's been enough of a public outcry. I haven't heard much about it in farming circles, you know, in the last few years. So I don't know if it's still a problem and people just got tired of talking about it or what.
Is there anything else you'd like to say, Ron, that we haven't covered?
No, it was great to be on the show. And if I can leave folks with anything, it's buy local, you know, and talk to your farms. And you have farmers directly, and you have a lot of power. If somebody is using a lot of manure, to say, hey, have you thought about, you know, trying to use veganic techniques? Have you thought about relying more heavily on cover crops? You have a lot of power as the consumer whenever you're directly speaking to your farmer. So do it. And they can call me if they need ideas on how to do it.
How can people get in touch with you?
Our website is www.flyingbeet.com, like a beet, vegetable beet flying through the air.
And there's an email address and phone
number
there?
Yeah, there's an email address there. And then there's Naturally Grown is www.naturallygrown.org.
And that's for the Certified Naturally Grown program?
Correct.
Okay.
And then you can see a list of farmers that might be in your area.
Okay,
great. So thanks a lot for being on the show, Ron. It's absolutely fascinating work you're doing.
Thanks for having me.
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
Good night.
And this has been another edition of the Vegan Rainbow Show with Bill Houston
and Mike Hudak.
And we will see you next time.